So hey everybody, Happy New Year. I'm happy to be back. This is Eric Mann. I'm the host of Voices from the Frontlines. For those millions of you who listen to the show all over the world, I missed you guys, especially the 15 or 20 people who write to me at Eric at Voices from the Frontlines. You're my favorites. And we got a big year ahead of us. We really do. We're going to try to take on President Obama. We're going to try to bring demands into the presidential elections, taking on Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. And President Obama, one of the things to know about President Obama is he's got a whole year in office, so he's not lame duck. That's baloney. That's part of how the Democrats try to frame it. He's got plenty of power, plenty of time. We just got to have a movement strong enough to make some demands on him. We're going to be talking today with Manuel Criollo, the Director of Organizing at the Labor Community Strategy Center, Ashley Franklin, Lead Organizer at the Strategy Center, myself, I'm the host, Eric Mann, you're on Voices from the Frontlines, KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming live on the web at kpfk.org. Also, check out our own website at www.voicesfromthefrontlines.com. It's a great website. If you miss any shows, just go download one. Just click on it. You can get them all back. All the commentaries we did, Prelude to Paris, Posts from Paris, Postscripts from Paris, which we're going to talk about. And what I'm going to do now is I'm going to do a brief commentary in preparation for a longer one about our dear, beloved, late friend, Haskell Wexler, the amazing, amazing human being, revolutionary filmmaker who we work with very closely. And then we're going to take a break, and then Ashley and Manuel and I are going to talk about the Paris Conference, the United Nations Framework Conference on Climate Change that we attended in Paris, France, for December 1st through 10th. And then around quarter to five, if you're still awake and alive and interested, we're going to go to the phones, and we'd love to hear from you, which is a big part of the show. So welcome. We're happy to be back on Voices from the Frontlines. Hey, Manuel. Hey, Ashley.
Hi, how are you?
Hey, Eric.
So these are my buds. We spend a lot of time together, so the only difference here is we're in studio talking to each other. I want to begin with Haskell Wexler. Many of you know who he is. He's an Academy Award nominated and Academy Award winner for Best Cinematographer. He won it for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. He won it for the Woody Guthrie film Bound for Glory. He was nominated for many others, so he's a top, top cinematographer. But the most important thing is he was a revolutionary. He was a movement person who is has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. And I'm going to just tell you, I mean, I am working on a longer tribute to Haskell that I want to try to do in the next couple of weeks. But I just want to, because he recently died shortly or around the holidays, just tell you a Haskell story, and we'll be telling you many more. One story, a backstory that I want to do more work on, is that I want to talk about two films when I do this article. One film is called The Salt of the Earth, and the other is called Bus Riders Union, which is also about the salt of the earth. So Haskell really loved working class people. That's what he did. And he was a filmmaker not just of the left, but he loved real people. He made the left come alive. He liked to do film about movements. He did a film about people going to the March on Washington on a bus. He did an amazing film called Medium Cool about the 1968 Democratic Convention. Very surprised he didn't do more films as a filmmaker, because he was a heck of a good filmmaker. So I'm just going to tell you a few stories about the film he did about us called Bus Riders Union, which is pretty cool. And I want to get it up on the website of www.voicesfromthefrontlines.com. It's not up right now. I don't know if it's up on the Strategy Center site, but that's a film that really I want to re-show in honor of Haskell sometime this year. So I'm going to just tell you an interesting story, which is the way a film gets made is I was in New York and get a call from the office and Michelle Pritchard from Liberty Hill. She's on the line and she wants to talk to you about something important. So I call Michelle and she says, "Hey, Eric, do you know who Haskell Wexler is?" So that's like telling me, well, of course I know who Haskell Wexler is. He also did a film about the Weather Underground. I mean, guys, super, of course, yes, I know who he is. I think he wants to do a film about you guys. I said, "Us?" She said, "Yeah, he came to me and said he wanted to do a film about something revolutionary." And the only people I thought of in L.A. that are doing work, because this was important. He wanted to do a film about people doing work that was revolutionary. And for those of you revolutionaries out there, you got to do real work. And he says, "Well, I thought of the only group I know that thinks they're trying to do revolutionary work is the Strategy Center and the Bus Riders Union." So I'm going, "Oh, unbelievable. He's going to do a film about us. This is not happening, you know." So we have this meeting with Haskell at the Strategy Center. It's Kikanza Ramsey, Chris Mathis, myself, and I forget who else, but mainly was Haskell, me, Chris, and Kikanza. So Haskell's going to do this revolutionary film about this revolutionary group. I'm so excited. So Haskell comes in and goes, "You know what I was thinking? I want to do a film to sort of show the human side of bus riders. You know, I want to go on the buses and find the average bus rider. You know, the bus rider who's just going through her normal day. I don't want to do one of those heavy political films, you know, with a big ideology. And I just want to more get to the roots of the people." And me and Kikanza and Chris are looking at each other like, "What the hell?" Here he wants to do a film about a revolutionary organization. Now, for those listeners who think that's interesting, let me tell you the subtext. Every bourgeois filmmaker says that. That it's like saying that if you're a revolutionary, you're not a real person. That the human side of Lenin, no, yeah, he was a human side. The human side of Mao, no. Like Chris Mathis used to say, for some of these folks, "For every book that I read, I'm less black. For every book I read, I'm less an average person." Well, I'm not trying to be an average person. But this idea that they want to do a human interest story, you know. So we're thinking, oh, my God, whatever happened to the film about us as revolutionaries? So Kikanza is furious, right? So she's very young and very moralistic and great. And she's going, "Well, listen, you know," and I sort of kick her under the table, you know, just chill. This is how, just let it go. So I said, "Haskell, that sounds really great. That's a great idea." I said, "You know, Haskell, I want to show you a film that was done about the work at General Motors. It's called Tiger by the Tail. It was done by this filmmaker named Mikkel Goldman." She really also wanted to show the human side of auto workers, but, you know, "I think you might like the film." So I give him the CD or the DVD, and clearly the effort was to change his mind on some stuff. So the film, which I wrote the script for, opens up with Ed Asner in very stentorian tones saying, "This is a film about auto workers. Not auto workers as victims, auto workers as strategists, auto workers as tacticians, auto workers taking on the largest industrial corporation in the world, and they think they can win. They have a unique strategy." And he goes through the whole thing and says, "And now, let's listen to those auto workers and their own voice." And then it opens to a big picture of the UAW Local 645. It's a beautiful picture, about 150 auto workers in groups of 10, all debating with such vitality about what they want to do as a movement. Yes, they were very compelling human beings. So the next morning, I get a call from Haskell. He says, "Eric, this is Haskell." I said, "Yeah." He says, "Oh, my God, I am so sorry." He says, "I must have sounded like a goddamn liberal. I sounded like an idiot. I can't believe who was saying that stuff." I said, "Thanks, Haskell. I thought you might." So the point is, the first thing about Haskell Wexler, he's an introspective human being who can be reached, who can be struggled with. And as he said, he did sound like a terrible liberal. And for a lot of our listeners out there, liberal is the worst word in our vocabulary if you don't know it. So for revolutionaries, a liberal is a half-hearted loser. So Haskell didn't want to be a half-hearted loser. Now, the second thing about Haskell is he says, "Well, you know, I want to hang around with you guys, and I think I'll do it in 2 or 3 months, you know." And again, Kikanza is going, "2 or 3 months? You don't know how long..." I said, "Kikanza, chill, man. But again, Kikanza's voice is the wonderful voice of the young, you know, not playing any games, you know, but she is saying, Haskell, it's going to take a while to figure out this movement. So we get started, and Haskell made a major investment. I mean, he started living with us, basically. He would, there was nothing too small that he was disinterested. I don't know if I used the right word, but he was interested in everything down to the smallest detail. And yes, he got to know real people, real organizers who he did fall in love with. Della Bonner, yes, Kikanza Ramsey, Dave McClure. He did an amazing vignette within a movie about Rosalia Mandiola, A Whole Life. He made Della Bonner come alive as a real historical figure. And yes, me. And he made Mayor Reardon come alive. And he made The Enemy and Connie Rice and John Walsh. So Haskell lived with us. And every time he'd be trying to, you know, so 3 months would go on. He'd go, he said, all right, I got to tie the film up. I said, well, the problem is, Haskell, that next week we're going to start the No Seat, No Fair campaign. He said, oh, we got to have that in the film. No, can't end the film without the No Seat, No Fair campaign. So that went on for 2 months. I said, well, now we're about to go to federal court. He goes, oh, got to go to federal. No, that's got to be in the film. So the main thing is he spent 3 years with us instead of 3 months. And he loved us, and we loved him. And it reached the point where Haskell was one, he was not a filmmaker. No, he was a filmmaker. But he was a filmmaker that was part of our movement. He would come to the meetings, he would listen, and he would use his wonderful eye and his wonderful camera to capture organizers as people, as strategists, and yes, as complex human beings. He died at 93. His body of work is almost impossible to comprehend. I urge you to Google him. And if you don't know who Haskell Wexler is, he died at, as I said, 93. And I think he must have worked for 70, 75 years. So Haskell, will be talking more about you. We'll never forget you. And for Della Bonner, if you're listening, and for Kikanza, and for all the bus riders, we owe you such a debt of gratitude. Any thoughts, any of my other compadres in the studio?
Well, you know, I'm now in the old fogey group, because I remember I came in the Strategy Center just as he was wrapping up the film. And one of the things that, at that time, relatively young person, was the big Hollywood premiere that we had, which was like incredible, because what I remember the most, and you know, I was a member at that time, was that we did it at the Directors Guild, and at the end of the film, everybody was like, you know, everybody, you know, the movie, if you haven't seen it, you know, as an organizer with the Bus Riders Union, we used to show that movie probably once every month, for sure, if not every week, and we all knew the lines. It was almost like we probably, you know, when we did the hunger strike and the encampment back in 2011, we actually did a kind of a sing-along to the movie, because most organizers and most members have seen the movie so many times. But what I remember the most about that moment was, wow, you know, like, he basically brought in all the organizers and members, and we probably had like 7,500 of our members there. And it was like such a beautiful moment to see a Woodrow, a Rosalio, a Barbara, a Shep, you know, basically an Eulalia, Amelia, who's to be the real superstars and movie stars of that day, you know. And I'd never forget that moment. I can only imagine for them, you know, that how proud of a beautiful moment that must have been for them. And you know, it's funny because my stepfather, God bless his soul, I don't think I ever comprehend him enough, but he really tried to politicize me when I was young. And he showed me a movie called Latino, which Haskell Wexler did. And in that film, it's basically about these Chicanos, two Chicano soldiers who are basically guns for hires, who are training the Contras in Nicaragua against the Sandinistas. And the film is basically about the guy having these massive internal fights about him being in Nicaragua, you know, training people, killing people who look like him or like that. And one of the things I remember about that film was that, you know, he steals a tortilla from one of the ladies, and she cusses him out in Central American Spanish, which then I really knew that. And in that moment, you know, I thought, oh, I would never want to be a soldier. You know, when I saw that, And it's funny, I totally had forgotten the film until I got into college, and somebody said, hey, let's go see this film. And I was like, all right, cool. And it's almost like, oh, that was that moment that I had, you know. And to know that he did that film, right, was pretty incredible for my own consciousness. And to then later on in life to be connected to him in that, in the way that the Strategy Center was, it just means a lot to me, you know, personally.
Well, one of the things that we've, you know, we're having trouble with today is that I think we are the stars. I think the organizers are, I don't just mean we, I mean all the people on the, this is called Voices from the Frontlines. And I think the people on the front lines have always been the stars. But in this present period, we have these so-called public intellectuals who have promoted themselves as the stars. And they have big audiences and big personal followings. They don't have a movement. They don't represent anybody. And people like us don't get the attention that we need. And Voices from the Frontlines try to do that. Haskell Wexler would never do a film about a public intellectual. He would do a film about Malcolm X. He would do a film about the Sandinistas. He would do a film about bus riders. And we need more filmmakers. We need more writers and social media people that will give more prominence to people on the front lines. So Haskell, if you can listen, you, Manuel's just telling the influence. Ash, got any stories, any thoughts?
You know, I think as one of the organizers who watched the film every month, because as we showed it to our members, it was one of those films that really, it was inspirational. It was inspirational because it made people think about what could possibly be the possibilities for change, and who are those movers and the shakers of making that change. And the film does a beautiful job of not just highlighting who were the leaders and the members at that time, but you could see yourself in each of the characters in the film. So I think for me, it was the beauty of seeing each person come to light and being able to pinpoint some of the characteristics that they had in yourself and wanting to grow and develop even more to push a movement forward. So I think that's the most memorable thing I have about the film.
Well, to make the story go full circle, when Haskell started, he said, you know, I want to make people come to life. And he started, but he fell into the trap of thinking that the only people who are real are not politically conscious people. And what he ended up doing is bringing us to life. You know, we became characters, three-dimensional, four-dimensional, five-dimensional people, that we are organizers, we're pretty funny, we're pretty interesting, we got our issues. And he got the story, ironically, his instincts were not wrong. You know, I mean, it was sort of a complicated thing where, as a great filmmaker, he made you think, I could be one of those people. Mm-hmm. He made you feel, wow, that I'd like to be part of that movement. And we need, God, Haskell, we miss you already. We do. I just saw him, just last story, as I told our friend. This is also about friendships, roles of friendships and relationships. Our very dear friend, Michelle Pritchard, who's been the director of the Liberty Hill Foundation, still works for Liberty Hill Foundation. Liberty Hill gave her an award, and which she well deserved. And in praising her, I did tell the story a little bit of how she introduced us to Haskell. So then Haskell came to the Strategy Center 26th political party a lot because he read my tribute to Michelle and said, oh, I just forgot all that, you know, how great all that hope, so I just came to honor you guys. So the circle of honor, Haskell, we honored Michelle, and in honoring Michelle, I honored Haskell. And then Haskell came to honor us, and now we are continuing the circle of honoring him. So pretty encouraging. And also for Rita Taggart, his wife of many years. Rita, we send you our deepest condolences and respect and caring, and we hope to see you soon. And Haskell, we know you're still out there, and we're still with you, my brother.
Here comes the sun.
So, hey everybody, welcome back to Voices from the Frontlines. This is Eric Mann. I'm the host of the show, and you're on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming live on the web at kpfk.org. You can reach me on Twitter at Eric Mann Speaks. You can go on our website www.voicesfromthefrontlines. It would mean a lot if you would register. You just go on and it'll say register for our mailing list. We put out a, thanks to our producer Channing Martinez, we put out a weekly announcement, usually on the Tuesday, about what the show is going to be about. Within about a day or two, the show is back up on our website, so you can listen to it. You could send an email to your friends if you like this and say, hey, check out the show. Go on www.voicesfromthefrontlines, and you can send me an email at eric@voicesfromthefrontlines.com. I would love to hear from you, and I'll read most of it on the air. So now I want to talk about climate change, President Obama, the work of the Strategy Center, and the experience that we had in Paris at the United Nations Framework Conference on Climate Change, which took place, as I said, in December of 2015. My worst fear is that I think very few people understood what it was. Very few people were following it at the level of what I was hoping for. Very few people know the difference of victory or defeat. Very few people care. That's the thing that's most scaring me. It's going to be a big theme of Voices this year, which is I disrespect most of the people that are doing work on climate change because they have so little interest in the specifics of what they're doing that I don't even get it. I mean, if you said somebody they're working on the death penalty and you said, well, how many people have been executed, they would know. If you told them, they would want to go into great detail about every law and every specific thing about the death penalty, and they would know every little case they want to talk about. When you talk to people about climate change, I'm talking to you, our listeners, there's very little engagement with the system and little awareness of what the system is doing and what the government is doing. The reason that's important is we want to change that on Voices from the Frontlines. We are initiating a national campaign. We have initiated it, and it has four demands. The first is that the United States and President Obama must cut U.S. emissions by 50% of 1990 levels by 2025. The second is asking the president to contribute $10 billion to the Green Climate Fund, which we'll talk about. We're asking President Obama to carry out an effective right of return of 100,000 internally displaced black people from New Orleans back to New Orleans. And we're calling on President Obama to end the Department of Defense 1033 program, which is a program that gives Defense Department weapons to local police departments, state the police departments, and basically further militarizes the primarily black and Latino communities and further militarizes any potential of dissent. So I wrote an article that you can see on the website. You can, it was also on Counterpunch. It was also on Huffington Post. And I really want to thank Peter Gamble, the editor of the Black Commentator, that made it the cover story of the Black Commentator, which is very important because one of the things that I heard about is that a very leading climate speaker, a well-known speaker, spoke in Chicago, and there were 1,000 people there, and 998 were white. And a leading black organizer wrote her a letter and said, what's wrong? You know, what is wrong with a movement where all you're attracting is white people? So we want to be clear at the Strategy Center and on this show, Voices from the Frontlines, that we are trying to build a multiracial movement of all people, but we see black people and Latino people at the center of any potential change for climate change. And that's what this show is about. This is the work. This is the delegation that we sent to Paris. So in the article, I'm just going to read you the headlines. I'm just going to start. The just concluded Paris Climate Conference, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, UNFCCC, was a critical junction in human and planetary history. Could the world's governments, all representing Homo sapiens, often at war with each other, come together to stop the capitalist and carbon-based catastrophe. That climate catastrophe, in less than 300 years, through the U.S. and European industrial counter-revolution, is destroying all that God and nature created for millions of years since the last mass extinction. So the article is trying to say that there's a phenomenal climate crisis, that we went to Paris and the world went to Paris trying to get the United States and the European countries, the European Union, to make radical, radical reductions in their emissions, and also to give a lot of money to the third world to develop, because the third world, which we'll get to, with all its many political problems and its own pollution and its own, in my opinion, not taking full responsibility in terms of India and China, nonetheless has been a product of a colonial system that denied them the ability to develop economically. And now that they're trying to develop themselves economically, they're stuck with coal, they're stuck with the most polluting fuels. And they're saying to the United States, well, you guys have had 300, not just 300 years, you built your system on the slavery of us. Now you have this, now you're talking about reducing your emissions and telling us why aren't we going to reduce our emissions. All right, fine. So why don't you give us money, substantial amount of money, and what's called technology transfer. Why don't you move actual solar to us? Why don't, if you're doing solar, you're doing wind, give us money for those technologies to get us off coal and don't just criticize our emissions. So in the article, it's called The Paris Climate Talks, A Victory for President Obama, A Defeat for the Planet, and A Challenge to the Climate Justice Movement. So I'm here in studio with Manuel Kiyoyo, the director of organizing at the Strategy Center, Ashley Franklin, the lead organizer at the Strategy Center. We also went with Barbara Lott Holland, the associate director of the Strategy Center, and Chetty Martinez, an organizer and media organizer with the Strategy Center. So we had a terrific group of five of us. We went to change the whole world, to make Obama knuckle under to our demands, and spoiler alert, we didn't quite succeed. So the struggle's continuing. And I just want to read you some of the headlines of this article about what failed. So the first thing it says is that the Paris Agreement, unless overturned by other movements and structures, is locking in a 3 degrees Celsius world. For those of you who've been following that, there's been talk about 1.5 degrees Celsius, no more than 2 degrees Celsius. But first of all, much of that is already happening in the world. Much of the world is already moving towards 1.5. And in fact, we're looking at a 3 degrees Celsius world in the next 20 and 30 years. It's going to have a disastrous effect on Africa in particular, which we'll talk about. The second is that the United States prevented any language for climate reparations. They went out of their way to even say the final document states, quote, any discussion of loss and damages does not involve or provide a basis for any liability or compensation. And liability means that you're held liable in a court of law. And, of course, compensation means you pay. So the United States is willing to say, yeah, I probably did some things in the past, but I will accept no liability or no responsibility to compensate. Next, it says President Obama, John Kerry, and Chief Negotiator Todd Stern effectively put the blame on China, India, and all those still in the developing world. Then it says the president's actual stated commitments to reduce UN's greenhouse gas emissions in Paris, only 14% of 1990 levels. One of the weakest proposals of a major power, let alone the world's still greatest polluter. Then it says the United States imposed its will on the world's nations and in Paris broke the back of any effective resistance to its domination of the United Nations. So then there's a whole section about where is the hope. And we're going to focus on where is the hope. We have 22 minutes. But I want to first focus a little bit on what was the problem and what did you learn? I mean, I think the thing for Ashley and Manuel is that Barbara Lott Holland and I, we've been sort of following this bouncing ball for a year. And we've been going to Paris, we've been going to Bonn, Germany. And for you guys, this is the first time you went. So you went to Paris. What was it like for you in terms of, let's start with what you learned about the zigs and zags of the concepts that I was just using?
Well, you know, for me, Strategy Center has always had an international component to its work and has always looked at the United Nations as an important arena of struggle. And the other objective that we went with, which is the idea about what are we going to do about the United States. But what struck me the most was that the environmental movement has an important anti-sort of corporate, anti, to a certain degree even anti-capitalist sort of perspective. But in some ways it's almost erases then the centrality of the specific nations that are creating the pollution that's caused the problem and that have been the major obstacle for any real agreement. And to me, that's what I found the hardest to try to navigate, how powerful those politics of an anti-corporate politics without necessarily naming the colonial and imperialist powers like the United States, Europe, all the settler nations like New Zealand and Canada. There is sort of a lack of trying to name who the main obstacles are by sort of blanking them to say it's Exxon, it's this corporation, without necessarily naming who harbors those corporations in the first place, and or to even, you know, whose militaries, you know, this talk, the issue about emissions, much of the emissions that are caused also by the, you know, like U.S. military or some of these major military forces and powers are not even counted in a country's sort of contribution to climate. So to me, it's sort of like you can't talk about only corporations without naming the governments. And I just sensed a big gap there of either people having the lack of will of saying that, because there is also a culture at the United Nations that sort of in the name of, you know, formality and presentation, you can't even name a government. But I think also that in some ways it's a tradition that's getting lost. And that was maybe the piece that scared me the most.
Well, in terms of back to you, staying with you, and we'll get to Ashley, is in terms of these white kids, because that's one of the other problems, is that there were black students from the historically black colleges mm-hmm. and universities. There were some Africans, but a substantial number of the people that thought they were going to Paris to protest were white people from either the United States or Europe. So what do you think that's about? Because, and both are like you and then Ashley to address, obviously we went to change that point of view. Mm-hmm. I don't think we succeeded all that great, but we tried. So maybe we will go to Ashley first and then back to you. Is what did we try and how did it go? What did you think? I don't mean to write your script for you. I mean, tell us what you tried to do there and what you think you did well and what you think, what were some of the barriers you hit when you were there?
Yeah. So, you know, I think that it's important to first start off and talk about then what's the dynamics. I think Manuel laid out what not being able to call out specific governments. And I think it was particularly groups and organizations that played by the rules. So in the space that we were in, you're not specifically make any demands on any entity. You're not supposed to call out any nation. And I think for us, it was clear we were going to talk about what are we going to do about the United States. So what we did was make signs, and we carried our petitions inside of the space. We actually held rallies in the space. So imagine a space that once said you can't call out a nation, we're chanting demands about a nation. A space that said that you can't chant at all, we were actually holding the ground where people were checking in, and they were like, whoa, what's going on here? These people are chanting, what are we going to do about the United States? President Obama, we're not down for your 1.5, and calling out all the farce of what was being put out. So what we tried was, I think, actually calling out nations, so calling out the U.S. And I think one of the most beautiful moments for me was being able to hold a sign that said, return the 100,000 displaced black folks to New Orleans, and having many people approach me, specifically from African nations, saying, what are you talking about? What displacement? So when I think about black folks in the movement around climate, I think we're at the front lines of the folks who are most hurt when climate disasters hit this country. So I always say, you know, the U.S., the country that is the biggest country in the world, who always thinks that climate disasters will never come to it. Hurricane Katrina is one of the telling stories of it did hit this country, and who it hurt the most were Black folks in New Orleans. And so being able to have these conversations with people who would have never thought that it was Black folks in the States who to this day haven't had the right to return home and were left to die if they survived the storm and weren't given any type of resources to escape the storm was, I think, very beautiful to have these conversations, because it's not what you see on TV. It's not what's being put out. So being able to have a demand on a Black president around the right to return for Black folks in New Orleans and having those conversations was beautiful.
I just want to say a minute on that. We're going to talk next week a lot about my new book coming out. But we brought this book, we're happy to say, a book that I was the primary writer of, but that Ashley did a lot of work on, that Manuel did a great deal. Manuel was the editor of the book. It's called Katrina's Legacy, The Black Nation, The Black Latino Alliance, Indigenous Peoples Movements, The Third Reconstruction, Nations of Africa, Asia, and Latin America, Third World Women, and the People of the World Confront the U.S. Imperialist White Settler State as Genocidal Climate Crimes. And that also includes this. I'm still trying to figure out how to, I think I'm going to call this, you know, Katrina's Legacy Volume 2 or Part 2. And then this, it also includes Katrina's Legacy Part 1, which is called Katrina's Legacy, White Racism and Black Reconstruction in New Orleans and the Gulf Coast. And that's also by Eric Mann, and that was edited by Leanne Hirstman. So the entire first book is there, and the entire second book is together. They're both about 200 pages. And I think what's relevant is that the right never gives up on an issue. Like, we won voting rights, they spent all their time getting rid of voting rights. We won civil rights, they get rid of civil rights. We won this. The movement is shocked that this book, Katrina's Legacy, is talking about 100,000 Black people who were internally displaced from New Orleans, but that happened in 2005. So here we are 10 years later at the UN, and we're saying we want 100,000 Black people back, and they're going, well, when did that happen? Well, we say 2005, 2006. Well, why are you still talking about it? Why? Because we think we're going to win the right to bring them back. So I think the fact that you did that, Ashley, as he said, it was a very positive effect of the book and our work. And for our listeners, on Thursday night, February 4th, we are going to have finally, the U.S. opening of Katrina's Legacy, Genocidal Climate Crimes. And we'll let you know about the place soon. So, very cool, Ash. And I want to also say that you in particular, you and Manuel, did a very good job of struggling with a lot of the same white students I was talking about. And I saw the impact, you know, that you had in just 3 or 4 or 5 days, where at the end they were marching with some of you guys at the leadership. Manuel, what were some of the things that, again, that you went through as an organizer in Paris?
Well, you know, I had never been to, well, when I had never crossed the Atlantic. So to me, that was a trip for me. That in itself was an experience. And to be in a ex-colonial and imperialist country like Europe and France, for somebody who for so long was told that that's the only form of beauty, or that's the only form of how developed happens, to me, the power of the United Nations was to see that a country like France or a country like Germany or a country like Britain became rich out of the other 150 nations of the South who have been plundered and pillaged. And to see and hear from people from all over the world was very powerful for me, you know, and that it's still so relevant that the Nigerians are talking about the ongoing killing of their people and the extraction of their wealth from these corporations, but these corporations that are run by specific countries, which is Britain and the United States. And also that the second piece for me was that in some ways, you know, in the United States, there still hasn't been a massive decolonization of the environmental movement.
That's a good one. You know,
because if we think about who were probably the first real environmentalists in this country, were indigenous people who were fighting against the encroachment of white people taking over their land, who were the first, you know, environmentalists to, you know, if you think about, you know, slave society, how destructive it was toward some people. And yet in some ways, people had to find a way to make a life out of basically scraps, right? And to me, the power of going to the United Nations was that to see that the world is massively different than what we think of in the United States, which for me, to be honest, I think of the world as being white because that's who I see on TV. That's who I grew up with most of my life. Obviously, those are times are changing now. But to be there to see that is much more transformative. And I think that was the hardest thing then, to see that the vast majority of the people who were there, at least from the United States, were virtually all white. And, you know, some of the two most powerful things for me at the UN Green Space was, one was, yes, the action that we started from a group that started with, you know, five people holding signs, having basically 150 people basically talking about climate reparations, naming governments, and for young people to sort of move, not just to say we're against corporate pollution, but we're specifically wanting to call out our own country or our own countries, was great. And the other piece was, you know, to see the power of the Black Lives Movement extend itself even out there. As you said, the historically black colleges and universities, which a delegation that was led by Dr. Robert Bullard and Dr. Beverly Wright, they had probably a very large a contingency. And they also had a very powerful action at the Green Space. And all of it was centralized around the destruction of, you know, basically U.S. lifestyle on black people. And there was a massive die-in that they held. And I think those, again, one of the things that our own objective was, how does climate and the black movement sort of merge? And in some ways, those two actions were two bookmarks to that kind of what we sort of imagined and sort of what happened.
This is Eric Mann. That voice you just heard was Manuel Criollo. The voice before that was Ashley Franklin. We're going to go to the phones if you can get there fast. I'm sorry I didn't give the number sooner. 818-985-5735. We'll only be able to take a few calls, obviously, towards the end, but we'd love you to hear, especially questions to Ashley and Manuel. 818-985-5735. Let me ask you this. If you're now in a group, I'm particularly talking about people who have unions or people who are in a church or people who are listeners. We would love, we at the Labor Community Strategy Center would love to come to your group and talk to you about climate. We would like to talk to you about what is President Obama doing on climate. What does it matter whether it's a 50% reduction or a 14% reduction? What are the demands we can bring on the president now? We are going to be asking the president to end the 1033 program for real. We are going to call on the president to make major reparations. See, the fact that the UN conference said that the document said that they don't agree with it doesn't mean he can't do it, folks. Guess what? They always want, you know, this document does not end the conversation. So we want to go in particular to groups. Write me at Eric at Voices from the Frontlines. Call us now at 818-985-5735. If you're interested in the Paris Conference on Climate Change, in particular, I'd like Manuel and Ashley to comment. You know, you could ask them questions and make comments. 818-985-5735. We already got Tony from Long Beach. We'll take it. And Tony, what's on your mind? You're on Voices from the Frontlines. This is Eric Mann with Manuel Criollo and Ashley Franklin. 818-985-5735. What's up, Tony?
Hey, I just wanted to say I love your tribute to Haskell. Real quick, I need some information. I'll leave my email. Years ago, I met Haskell and also Sal Landall. And I'm African-American, and they, out of just kindness to me, said, hey, I'm going to send you three of our best films. Haskell and Sal Landall sent me Conversation with Allende, Torture in Brazil, and I forgot the third film. Anyway, I had gone to Argentina, and I was unable to thank them, and I want to find out if you have any resource that I could contact relatives or friends. They just gave me the documentaries, and it's really, I'm just really touched by how beautiful they were towards me, and the fact that Haskell's gone, it just makes me very sad. Do you have any contact?
Yeah, Tony, this is what I'd like you to do. Thank you. You're the perfect person to call. Send me an email, eric@voicesfromthefrontlines.com. Sal Landa also died. And
right,
no, I'm just saying these are two great white filmmakers who got third world people who cared about young black filmmakers. So love to put you in touch with people. So send it to me, Tony, at eric@voicesfromthefrontlines.com, and as well as other listeners, and I will be back in touch with you personally, okay? Thank you so much for that nice story. Mars from Long Beach, you're on Voices from the Frontlines with Eric Mann, Manuel Criollo, and Ashley Franklin. What's up, Mars?
Eric, I wanted to ask you your personal opinion. In New York City, not too long ago, there was a climate change protest march. 400,000 people participated in that. 400,000 people. That's four times the number of people at the Michigan State-Michigan football game. Yet it got no news coverage. Do you think that it was coincidental or an accident that during that conference in France regarding the climate change that there were no marchings going to be taking place and no permits were going to be issued?
Yeah, Maurice, that's a great question. I mean, I do think, the French government basically denied any protest during that period. And rightfully, some of the people we met would say, well, but, the dance clubs are still open, the football clubs are still open, and people, these are massive numbers of people who are in one space. And, the government basically squashed any action. And in fact, when we first got there, a set of activists were put under house arrest, right, under sort of a big code. That's why for us, this demand around ending the 1033 program is so important. A lot of people say, well, I don't understand, the 1033 is mainly about, militarization. But, as Ashley was talking about earlier, if you look at the future crimes against our people, the way that's going to happen, on one hand, it's going to be the impacts of Mother Nature. But the second one is going to be how the state reacts.
That's right.
When people are hungry, when people are desperate. So I definitely think that, part of the unfortunate thing that played out in some ways was that there was no actions on the streets. The only thing I would say for the listeners that, again, there's just a lot to unpack, and I know we're going to probably have some kind of forum later on in the next couple months, is that, the only other thing that I would say that unfortunately is playing out is that, when people are talking about actions in the street, it's almost that like they're almost like trying to deny that there was a big actual discussion about important points about what governments were doing, what people were, how corporations were taking over the whole process. And in some ways have sort of pushed it out of the side and think only the streets are gonna win that. And I think it's something that we should at least problematize. That's not that simple. It's not to say only the streets are gonna resolve it. If we're not inside that process, trying to, almost die for each comma or period or each line that's going to be very effective to our people. And I think in some ways there has to be a better merger of those two things that are playing out.
I think we're going to have to educate our young people, and I think it starts in the elementary schools. Okay, if I were giving a speech at elementary school, I would tell those kids, do not show up here again unless mom and dad are going to participate in establishing the curriculum of this school to let me know what's going on. And if they don't know what's going on, listen to KPFK to get some guidelines. And that's where I'm at with this, because 20 years from now, I might be dead. But my grandkids are going to have a problem growing some food, okay? So we better consider that. And thanks for taking my call, Eric.
Hey, Mars, great to hear from you. Eric@voicesfromthefrontlines. Mars, send me an email. Me and Manuel and Ashley want to stay in touch with you. We're happy to hear from Matt from Topanga. Maybe our last call, KPFK 818-985-5735. Can we take this call? Yeah, this is our last call. Go ahead, Matt. Say something profound.
Okay, hi. I think that as far as we really got to get back on the subject of the TPP, any of these, talking about the most absorbent mop for the leak and the faucet are going to be nothing if this levee breaks.
Well, thanks. Come back to that in a minute. In the last 4 minutes, let's each have our last minute. Miss Franklin, what's your closing perception of Paris and things you want the listeners to know and do?
Closing remarks would be simply that there
1033 is not simply just a military program, but understand that it's a military get-up program in the sense that they're intending to go to war with Black and Brown and working-class communities. So what that means is if we're not in the streets fighting, if we're not on our blocks organizing, or if we're not in our schools organizing, we will be losing the war. So fight.
Senor.
You know, I think I come back with so much anger and rigor and responsibility of being there. I think of all the things, you know, another day we could tell you all the sad stories of what didn't happen. But in some ways, what I'm feeling the most is my responsibility to do something, you know, and in some ways more profound than even when I left.
Well, if that's our end, then that makes me inspired. This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines. It's fun to be back. We love the show. We really do. We put a lot of energy into it. When we get calls like this, it makes us happy. You know, it means this is fine people out there. 818-985-5735. Goodbye. All power to the people. I want to thank G, our producer. I want to thank Channing Martinez. We'll see you next Tuesday at 4. You're on Voices from the Frontlines. All power to the people. Little love.